From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Civil asset forfeiture represents a threat to private property rights in North Carolina and across the country. The head of a national group called the Institute for Justice joins us. He'll explain why his group fights asset forfeiture abuse. North Carolina policymakers hope to improve some of the state's worst-performing schools through a new innovative school district. You'll hear highlights from a recent legislative debate about the district. 10 years after a landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling protecting gun rights, the legal landscape doesn't look as good for gun rights advocates. The attorney who won the court case explains why. And we'll learn why a recent poll doesn't tell us as much as we might think about Democrats, Republicans, and their attitudes about public school spending. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Data from a national moving service shows that when it comes to household moves between the states, in 2017, North Carolina was one of the top five inbound states. That is, 62% of our moves were coming into North Carolina, with only 38% moving out. The big question is why? Our next guest may have some insight into that. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She's been writing about North Carolina's economic transformation. Becky, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
So more people want to come here and fewer people want to move out. That's a good thing.
There you go. Great news for North Carolina. This is a real message that we're doing things right here. Now, first of all, I think we have to start this. In all fairness, we have beautiful beaches, we have the mountains, we have diversity of jobs, diversity of people, you know, all of those things. So there's kind of the natural resource piece of this. Generally, you know, and now spring is finally underway. You know, we have beautiful weather, you know, all of those things. But the other thing is lots of other states have those benefits as well. Why are people choosing North Carolina? I would argue that it's in large part because of some of these pro-growth policies that have been put into place since 2011. We've seen reduction in taxes. We've seen reining in the growth of government. Common sense fiscal and budget decisions have been made here. There are more jobs available here. Some of the investments that we've made in education are improving the educational opportunities for folks. Investments in transportation and things like that have really transformed our state. And so I think that's why people are moving here. We're doing things right.
It's interesting that you brought up the issue of the geography and the beauty and all that, because people do take a look at things like that and they compare all sorts of things when they're making a move. Sometimes it's for a job. Sometimes it's to come here to go to school. Maybe it's a corporate leader's looking at where they want their business to grow. So
a lot of retirees are choosing to move to North Carolina.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously lots of choices. So many, many people are choosing to move here. Our population is growing. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of opportunity. Tell us a little bit more about what has occurred over the past few years when it comes to job opportunities and keeping more of what we earn.
Well, some of these pro-growth policies that have to do with fewer regulation, lower tax burden, more sensible spending and growth of state government have been a real encouragement and incentive for businesses to come here. And with businesses come jobs and opportunity for people that live here. Donna, since 2013, we've had over 440,000 net new jobs created here in North Carolina. Interestingly enough, though, with our job growth, there have been fewer jobs in government, but much more jobs in the private sector. So what we're seeing is a move away from dependency on government and taxpayers and more of a dependency on the private market, opening up opportunities for job seekers, for businesses, for entrepreneurs. And I think that people are responding to this. There's a lot of data out there, a lot of the measures that economic forecasters use, whether it's unemployment rate, GDP, wage growth, those kind of measures, and all of those, the economics tell us North Carolina is doing right. But I think in these statistics that you have cited of people choosing to move here in North Carolina, it's not just a set of numbers. It's not just a set of anecdotes. People really are seeing the difference here in North Carolina, and they're choosing to move here.
When job creators take a look at where they want to bring their businesses, and it's interesting that there's all sorts of things they look at, not just the corporate income tax rate, which has been lowered over the past few years, but they're taking a look at fiscal issues that the state has taken actions on, because that's the way they operate their own businesses. So they would want to see, what kind of a state am I looking at moving to? Talk to us a little bit about the restraint on spending of tax money and setting ourselves up for a rainy day.
Donna, in response to why are businesses choosing to move here, what is the incentive here for them? It's a lot of things. It's sustainability. It's reliability of what they can expect. So as they make their investments, they know what that's going to look like. Some of those things that we've done in North Carolina is put money aside in savings accounts. Now, this is important for a number of reasons. One, so that if we have a natural disaster, and since we're on the coast, you know, we need to responsibly prepare for hurricanes, flooding, any kind of natural disaster. But even further than that, when we have a downturn in the economy again, and it's not if, it's when that's going to occur.
Because the economy is cyclical.
And there are a lot of things that are out of control of North Carolina decision makers. I mean, you know, national decisions, international decisions impact the economy. So we need to, what we can do in North Carolina is prepare for that and position ourselves for the fast and best recovery when that happens. Having savings accounts set aside, and right now, North Carolina savings are at the highest they have ever been in the history of the state. So what that means is, with these fluctuations in the economy, North Carolina is positioned to continue core functions of government. We can pay teachers, we can pay police officers, we can keep the courtrooms open, we can keep highway patrolmen on our transportation system without raising taxes on citizens and businesses. So that stability is extremely important. Something else that we've done that as far as incentivizing businesses and individuals to come here, so we've made real efforts to keep energy costs low. Now, imagine if you all would, you're a business considering moving here to North Carolina, maybe some of the manufacturing, maybe some of the food services, agribusiness, pharmaceuticals, any of those things that use a lot of energy. In addition to lower taxes, fewer regulation, sustainability of government services, we also have low energy cost. And these are things that businesses look at as they move in. Also keeping low energy cost, Donna, you know, all of this is not just about bringing businesses in. It's also taking care of all North Carolinians. So when we have low energy cost, our low-income neighbors have a break on that and are able to spend their money more in ways that they choose to, rather than having high electric bills during the summer or the winter or those kind of things. So all of these things, it's an incentive to businesses to come. They're the job creators. We want to get people back to work. But this benefits, all of these things I've mentioned also benefit our low-income neighbors across North Carolina as well.
Becky, it's been really curious to juxtapose the actions of the federal government over the last few months with the actions of policymakers here in North Carolina. We've seen tax cuts and tax reform at the federal level as well, but at the federal level, there has not been this spending restraint
exactly
that North Carolina has made sure was coupled with tax cuts and tax reform. So on the one hand, it's good that federal policymakers understand about economic growth and the need to let people keep more of their money, but they're not keeping spending in check.
No, but a couple things. Let me make a couple points there. If you compare the federal tax cuts and North Carolina tax cuts, you will discover that they're very similar. That is no accident. North Carolina has become a model not only for other states of how to reform taxes, but for the federal government itself. And as a matter of fact, at the Locke Foundation, we were called by the White House Domestic Policy Office during these negotiations of how are you doing that in North Carolina? How did that work? How do you couple this together so that you incentivize business, but at the same time keep tax rates low for individuals as well? Again, you know, as you mentioned, what they didn't do that we recommended and we are the model for is at the same time that you have tax cuts to also bring efficiencies, get rid of waste and abuse in the spending end of it. It's a two-part program here. It's a two-part reform. So we will continue to encourage the federal government to rein in the growth of government as well. In the meantime, we will continue to be a model across the country.
Our guest has been Becky Gray. She is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Becky, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Civil asset forfeiture is a process that allows law enforcement agencies to seize your property even if you've not been convicted of any crime. Well, our next guest leads a group that focuses attention on the problems linked to civil asset forfeiture and other related threats against property rights. Scott Bullock is president and general counsel at the Institute for Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
For people who are unfamiliar, just a quick reminder, what is civil asset forfeiture?
Well, it's this bizarre power of government that most people are shocked to find out even exists in a country that's supposed to respect private property rights and due process. It is the power of the government to seize your home, your business, your car, your cash, regardless of whether or not you've been convicted or even charged with a crime. And it operates under this legal fiction that the property is somehow guilty of activity. So civil forfeiture cases have these bizarre names like United States of America versus $2,500 in U.S. currency, or State of Texas versus a Chevrolet Silverado, like the property committed the crime. And what it really amounts to is a convenient excuse for law enforcement agencies to take property that then they financially benefit from.
How big of a problem is it?
Well, it's huge. The federal government does it, and most state governments do it. And the federal government, it generates billions of dollars a year. At the state and local level, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And it's important to point out, too, that this is distinct from criminal forfeiture. I mean, you don't want people to benefit from illegal activity. If somebody defrauds a company and they've taken all the assets and bought a bunch of stuff for their own personal gain, the government should have the ability under certain circumstances and with constitutional protections to go and take that property. But with civil forfeiture, it doesn't matter whether or not you've been convicted or, as I said, even charged with a crime. And the primary problem with civil forfeiture laws is that law enforcement agencies, in addition to the power of civil forfeiture, but they get to financially benefit from this. All of it goes back to the very people who are out there enforcing the laws, which gives them a corrupt and perverse financial incentive to take as much property as possible rather than pursuing justice.
Frequent listeners to this program may know that North Carolina is different from other states
That's
in
right.
how it approaches civil asset forfeiture. Our state law, from what I understand, is pretty good, but we fall behind when it comes to how the state law enforcement agencies deal with the feds.
That's exactly right. North Carolina has which basically doesn't allow it, with some exceptions on the state level. But what you see in so many states that have pretty good civil forfeiture laws at the state level is that they work with the federal government in order to evade state laws. And under federal law, if it's passed off to the federal government, then the forfeiture can proceed and the feds keep 20% and then funnel 80% 80% back to state and local law enforcement. That's through processes called adoption and equitable sharing, which kind of sound nice in theory. But what it really is it's violating people's property rights, and it's violating principles of federalism as well, because it is really an attempt to evade state law. People in North Carolina have decided that we don't want to give this power to government, but they work around that and work with the feds in order to take the property.
We are chatting with Scott Block, who is the president and general counsel at the Institute for Justice. What could be done about this?
Well, there's a lot of things that are being done. And what's really encouraging is in the 7 years, 8 years now that we've started a campaign against civil forfeiture, there's been some profound changes. Over 20 states have changed their laws to better protect property owners. Courts are once again becoming more protective of property owners and their rights in this process. And so that's been very encouraging. Congress is once again starting to look at these laws and saying something needs to be done about them. But one of the things that we're looking to do is to bring this issue back before the Supreme Court, too. The court has not looked at this issue in over 20 years. Justice Thomas just issued a concurrence, recently an opinion where he said it's time for us to start seriously looking at civil forfeiture laws again. And so we think the time is really ripe to get this issue before the Supreme Court.
The Institute for Justice has been working on civil asset forfeiture, but you also see some other related or spin-off threats to property rights. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we've seen happen in a number of different instances where government agencies are financially benefiting from their enforcement decisions. And this creates this perverse financial incentive that exists in civil forfeiture laws, but it's also happening in a lot of other areas as well that impact private property rights. And one of the issues that we've become increasingly involved in is government's reliance on fines and fees, where they are looking for excuses really to shake down citizens as opposed to really being concerned about, for instance, property code enforcement. And so we see this in a number of different cities where governments are looking to kind of fine people for minor violations of a city code, which could be even something as minor as not having matched drapes in your basement windows, or in a case that we just filed this week in California where a person had some illegal chickens in their yard and then was had a minor fine, but then ended up having to pay over close to $6,000 in fees, not only to the government but to a private law firm that was enforcing these laws on behalf of the city. And again, it's not really about truly protecting public health and safety. It's about trying to extract as much money from citizens. And it's a growing problem throughout the country. It is related to civil forfeiture, and it's something that we're dedicating a lot of time and resources to try to putting a stop to.
Why is it important that we go ahead and have some sort of action on this front and stop government from using this enforcement mechanism basically is a moneymaker?
Well, it violates private property rights. It violates rights to due process. And it also kind of corrupts government decision making as well. Every economist will tell you that incentives matter. And if you give government actors incentives to financially benefit from their enforcement decisions, it's not surprising that they're going to devote more resources toward those types of enforcement actions rather than what they should be focused on, which is pursuing justice and truly protecting public health and safety.
Do you see some positive signs? You mentioned earlier that a number of states have changed their civil asset forfeiture laws. Are people getting it, or is this still an uphill battle?
Well, people are increasingly getting it, and that's really encouraging to see. It's one of these things where once you explain it to people, people can't believe that it even exists. And you say, yeah, this is actually a power that happens in the U.S. And so we fought for a number of years battles on eminent domain abuse, where government was taking property not for public uses but for private development projects. And people thought, how can this even happen in a country that's supposed to respect private property rights and other constitutional rights? And is there a similar reaction to forfeiture? Typically, the only people that support it are people that stand to benefit from it. And that's why we're very encouraged by kind of the progress we've made. But, you know, there's a lot of powerful interest groups on the other side of the equation that that are fighting to keep these laws in place.
Well, as these threats to private property rights proceed, one group that will continue working against them and protecting private property rights is the Institute for Justice. Scott Bullock is the president and general counsel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers hope to help some of North Carolina's worst-performing public schools through a new innovative school district. During a recent briefing on the new district, Republican Senator Ronald Rabin asked a basic question about its work.
What you presented is a very nice model of how to get better. But what I don't see, and it may be there and I just don't see it, you know, just one of those things. We understand that we have low-performing schools. To me, that's a result. What kind of data have you collected, or what do you know about the causal agents of the school failure? What's the real problem that underlies this requirement and this need? Because if we don't understand that, then every one of these projects becomes a shotgun to try to find out how to fix a problem without being very directive in our resources and directive in how we attack the problem. Like family keeps coming up. There's no doubt, in my mind anyhow, and I don't know about any else, where families are involved, students tend to do better. But having the PTA in place, that's not a family substitute. That's just, you know, a group of people that may or may not include the children who are not getting the education for other reasons. So am I right or wrong? And, you know, here's the surface. We got a problem. Let's shotgun it, as opposed to finding out what truly causes the problem and how can we fix that as part of the program.
I think you bring up an extremely important point. Having worked in communities and schools and in partnership with public schools across the state and having done a lot of work before that across the country, you're absolutely right. There are other barriers that children face when they come to school. There's the academic barriers that happen within the school, and there's the non-academic barriers that children are dealing with when they enter that school building each and every day. Part of our proposal, when we're looking at applicants that are considering to do this work with us, we are asking, what is their community-based strategy? What are the other partners that they're going to be looking at to help be involved in this? Because if we don't do something comprehensive, and we look at the school site alone, only through instruction, and we try to do that in a vacuum, we're going to miss the greater opportunities to address the community-wide factors that we need to look at. We hear about the common factors of poverty and the barriers that come with that. We also know that there are some schools out there that are really doing a great job of dealing with those factors and create the right environment and see kids thriving and achieving. So we have to continue to learn. We have to get better. To me, that's part of an organization when it starts, is looking at the lessons learned from other places and being committed to learning and growing as we get better and better at this work.
That's Eric Hall, superintendent of North Carolina's new innovative school district. It's designed to help boost the state's worst performing schools. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. 10 years have passed since a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case known as Heller. It protected Second Amendment gun rights. But the ruling hasn't had the impact gun rights advocates might have wanted. During a recent Campbell Law School forum, Alan Gura explained why. Gura is the lawyer who won the Heller case. He says many federal judges today don't support the ruling.
They don't think it's legitimate. They don't believe that it's real. And absent actually being compelled by the Supreme Court to do so, they will not enforce it. It is quite obviously a dead letter in much of the United States. I don't think there's any serious question of that.
That observation leads Gura to a basic question about the Heller ruling.
So is Heller something that's going to survive? Given the intensity of the resistance to it, I am not so sure that it will. It's interesting that a couple summers ago in 2016, I was invited to be sort of the symbolic pro-gun rights speaker at a panel at the American Constitution Society's National Conference. And the debate that we had there, remember, this is the summer of 2016. Everyone's sure that Hillary Clinton is about to be inaugurated and Merrick Garland is going to be confirmed, or maybe even somebody better from the left's perspective. The question was not whether Heller would survive, but how would it die? And I was the one voice on the panel who said, well, as soon as they get to five, they'll overrule it because they just can't stand it. And most of my friends on the other side said, no, you don't have to worry about that. They'll keep it around because it's too politically devastating to overturn. it just won't mean a whole lot. It'll just be narrowed, you know, into nothingness. And that, you know, didn't seem right to me. I too saw the votes come in, including Judge Garland's vote in Parker, and I didn't think that the left would accommodate Heller for 5 seconds. Nonetheless, whether it's overruled as a formal matter or overruled by neglect or by willful disobedience, the end result is the same. This is a decision that, I suppose, like any other decision that's published in U.S. reports, only means something if judges are there to enforce it. In that way, Heller is no different than any part of the Constitution itself. We have this parchment, and it says all kinds of interesting things about the limits we place on government and the power that we grant the government. But when push comes to shove, if the judges sneer at it and they simply are unwilling to give it any effect, then our Constitution is no more effective than the glorious freedom-granting, securing constitutions that were enacted by Joseph Stalin in 1938.
That's Alan Gura. He's the attorney who won the Heller gun rights case at the U.S. Supreme Court 10 years ago. He has seen that ruling threatened by other court rulings during the past decade.
It's quite appropriate for the Supreme Court, when it is called upon to interpret the Constitution, to apply the Constitution to present-day reality, to ask themselves, what did the framers of this text understand this text to mean? How was this language used during the day? And those concepts that were then enshrined are the concepts that we are to apply today. If the Constitution does not mean what the framers thought it meant, then it doesn't really mean anything, right? They're just words on a paper, and you can fill in the blanks or empty vessel, and you can pour whatever content you want into those provisions. So I don't think Heller is vulnerable on the history. I think it makes quite a bit of sense on the matter of history. But the problem is that we entrust this process, as we have to. Somebody has to make these decisions. We entrust it to a class of people who, by and large, are unwilling to accommodate themselves to this and don't believe it and don't care and aren't going to enforce the decision. It might as well not have been issued in some courts.
Given the current state of federal courts' approach to gun rights, where do things stand for the Second Amendment?
The reality is that I and other lawyers have clients who come to us. They have real serious questions that arise under the Second Amendment, questions that, regardless of how you think they should turn out, any fair-minded attorney or judge could say, well, that's an interesting Second Amendment question. You know, a court should decide this. And I ask the potential client, where are you? And if they are within certain circuits, I say, forget it. It doesn't really matter. Because you can't get a panel that's going to buy it. And it doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter what the law is. You see the type of decision-making which can only be called results-oriented.
Gura says some judges are more likely to rely on the dissent in the Heller case than the majority opinion. Others engage in a process described as narrowing from below.
The idea is that there are some decisions of the Supreme Court that are either so wrong or so impracticable or so offensive, for whatever reason, they are narrowed from below by the lower courts that don't give them the most reasonable construction, but give them the most palatable one, or at least palatable to the judicial class. And of course, Heller is one of these areas. The passage of time has seen Heller's legacy shrink to the point that it may soon be regarded as mostly symbolic. I can't argue with that.
What does this narrowing from below mean for the future of constitutional law? Gura doesn't like what he sees.
Put aside whether you think this is good or bad from a normative standpoint about gun laws, how you feel about firearms and gun rights, whether this is good or bad for America. Ask yourselves what this does to us as a nation that's supposed to be a nation of laws and not men or women. We have female judges too. I mean, is it really the fact that we are the kind of country, the president has used words recently to describe certain places where the rule of law does not usually carry the day, where you go to the lawyer's office and the lawyer says, well, you're going to win or lose based on who the judge is sitting today. Is that really what we want for anything, but most especially for the Constitution? We have an understanding that we teach at this law school and others that we have a system of vertical precedent. The Supreme Court is up here, then you have the intermediate courts of appeal, then you have the trial courts. Every state has its own hierarchy. And when one court says something, the lower courts are supposed to follow it. And that gives the law its essential value, predictability, right? One of the values that law does is it informs us what our rights and duties are. How are we to behave? How will the next case turn out based upon the reasoning of the previous case? And that requires judges to make decisions that they don't personally like. So even if you think Heller is wrong and horrible and terrible, the history was bad, the consequences for America are terrible, it caused all these problems, that's all well and good, but this is the Supreme Court's doctrine. And now we have very intelligent scholars who are not, you know, gun rights advocates by any measure, who can come in and tell you, as an objective matter, this is a symbolic opinion. This is not given its best construction. People are following the dissent. I would make a prediction that if this phenomenon were to continue, that a lot of the people who are okay with the practice might someday have some very long faces when the tables are turned and something that they care about as a matter of precedent is limited into oblivion. But what I'm mostly concerned about is not the feelings of people on the other side, and, you know, we can laugh about turnabout and fair play. I'm mostly concerned about what this is doing to Americans, to my clients and to people in the public who are becoming cynical about the mission of the federal courts.
That's Alan Gura. He's the lawyer who won the Heller gun rights case at the U.S. Supreme Court 10 years ago. He's concerned about the way courts have responded to that ruling over the past decade. He shared his concerns recently in a Campbell Law School forum. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal. And we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The latest High Point University poll concludes that North Carolina Republicans and Democrats agree on many education issues. Now, that declaration has some analysts scratching their heads, since some of the most hotly debated policies relate to how we pay teachers, how we assess achievement, and who should decide where kids go to school. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. He, of course, analyzes and writes about all of these education issues, and the High Point poll definitely caught his eye. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
So one of the questions of the poll did make sense to me, the results. It talked about the issue of respect for teachers and faculty members and folks who try to really train the next generation of Americans. High respect there. So agreement on that, no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think everyone agrees that teaching is a difficult job. You just have to look at things like the Parkland school shooting to realize that teachers not only have to deal with the academic side, but there are student misbehaviors. There are other issues that make it a very difficult job. And so I think that there's a good there's good evidence that there's high respect for the profession, that both Democrats and Republicans agree that it's a very difficult job and that they're probably underappreciated.
Then the question started to come up with really curious answers. On the issue of funding for schools with high numbers of disabled or poor kids, the results were that a majority said they would support legislation to provide more funding to schools with high concentrations of kids who have issues. Well, Terry, number one, isn't that already the case that these schools are receiving additional funding for particular challenges?
Absolutely. The state funding formula is designed to provide additional funds for school districts that have high numbers of low-income kids, that have high numbers of special needs children, and encounter low levels of support from their local school or the local county commission because of limited tax revenue. So we already have a structure in place where our lowest income counties receive a higher amount of state revenue. It's also the case that federal funding follows those school districts that have a high number of special needs children, high number of low income children in the way that that's structured. So we have in place already mechanisms that provide additional funding for counties that have these kinds of challenges.
Now, I have to say, it was rather encouraging to know that people are very concerned, wanting to make sure that kids who are disabled or have special challenges receive the focus that they need. We do in this state have a couple of scholarships that really address that, and one would think that that concern and support shown in this poll would transfer over to support for these special scholarships.
That's absolutely right. So when you think about it, we provide all the support for these struggling school districts. And when they're not able to deliver, we actually add another layer of support, allowing parents that are dissatisfied with the education these children are receiving in these places to be able to take a voucher, the opportunity scholarship for low-income kids, and the disability grant for students that have a documented disability to provide funding for them to take public money to a private institution that better meets their needs. So we actually have two layers of support for these families. One, providing additional funds for the district schools, and two, when the district schools aren't working out, allowing them to take public funding to private schools.
Yet we know, just based on our experience of watching the policy debate, and you, of course, are very much involved in that in North Carolina, over issues of choice and vouchers and scholarships, that people don't agree on this. It's highly debated.
It really is. And it's unfortunate that it is highly debated, because you find the parent satisfaction with these programs is really high, and the parents indicate that it's not a easy choice for them to just take public money and take it to a private school. It's a very difficult decision. They do it based on the fact that they feel that their child is not receiving a good education or is threatened with safety or other considerations that would make their continued education in a district school a detriment to the future goals and dreams and aspirations that they have. So, it is the case that these programs are put into place to meet the needs of these parents. And largely, it's Republicans that believe that these programs are a good idea, and Democrats oppose them.
Terry, also in the High Point poll, there's a question about virtual charter schools. And the conclusion was that there is a lack of support across the political aisle for virtual charter schools. First of all, did that surprise you?
It did. But when you look at the question, it's really misleading, because the question basically asked, do you support schools that allow kids to stay at home and learn online full time? Well, that just suggests that there's a child that's unsupervised that's going on the internet and learning what they can off the internet.
When goofing
the
truth off, is, essentially.
Yes, essentially. when virtual schooling is a highly structured activity where there's a full-time teacher on the other side guiding that student through a very rigorous curriculum. And if parents had an idea of what virtual schooling looked like, especially full-time virtual schooling, I think they would have a very different opinion of whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, because the perception is that these are kids at home surfing the internet. The reality is that these are kids that are in a very structured and rigorous program with a full-time certified teacher on the other side being held accountable for their results through state tests and various other measures.
I think that's an important point. When I have just talked with people about the question of a virtual school, they kind of feel like it is completely outside the system, so to speak, and that there's no assessment and therefore no way to know if your child is actually learning. That's not the case, though.
Absolutely not the case. They are held to the same accountability standards as any district school student is. And so when you look at state test scores, you can see the state test scores for the state's virtual charter schools. Now, it's kind of misleading when you look at those test scores because students are constantly moving in and out of the virtual schools. So you find that they're not necessarily doing as well as maybe some of the other charter schools or the state's virtual charter school. The state has its own virtual charter or virtual public school. But nevertheless, the accountability standards are there. And the state takes a very close look at how these virtual charter schools are performing to make sure that they're providing the highest quality education, certainly the education these children and families deserve.
Terry, why is empowering parents, giving them the ability to decide where their child goes to school and what environment is best for their child, why is that controversial?
Well, it's controversial because there are folks that want to maintain the status quo. They have a lot invested in the traditional system where students go sit in a classroom that's funded almost exclusively from public schools, that's run or by the public treasury, that's run by a local school board. There's an idea that this is the ideal educational situation for every family. And the truth is that it's not and never has been. But those who would like to maintain the status quo and have something invested in maintaining the status quo want to see it continue.
It just seems counterintuitive that there would still be folks who believe that a traditional public classroom should be able to serve every child.
Around 82% of North Carolina students are in the traditional public school, the district schools that we're all used to knowing about. And the support for choices is actually growing. So we're seeing more people supporting public charter schools, more people supporting homeschooling, and private schooling is actually enrollments increasing as well. So there is some support for these choices, but it's growing very slowly.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is VP of Research and Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.